There is an emergency announcement for the Reverend James Hayes, H-A-Y-E-S. The writing is not clear. It could be the Reverend James Hager, H-A-G-E-R. If there's a person here by either name, will you go immediately, please, to the information desk. Pages on our serving us this afternoon, the one on the platform is Joy Lubert. The one at the desk here with the general chairman is Barbara Hoffmeyer. And then serving us from the information booth are Marcia Hunter and Candy Moore. I would like to announce that at the close of the afternoon session, or 30 minutes following adjournment of the afternoon session, let us say, there will be an executive session of the WMU Executive Board in Room 10, the level above this, up the ramp. The speeches, most of the speeches that have been delivered here, will be on sale after the adjournment, not before, and throughout the remainder of the week. These sell for $1, and you can find the places where they'll be sold in the corridors. I would like to call your attention to the convention, which opens this evening in this auditorium. As I've looked at this auditorium, I have wondered if any of you who are sitting out there in the audience could have any idea what this auditorium looked like, let's say, Friday morning of last week. I can hardly believe my eyes each time I walk in here and see it. For some months ago, in preparation for this meeting, Mrs. Mathis and I came to New Orleans with Mr. John Williams of the Executive Committee of the Convention, and we were met by Mr. Penn, the manager of this auditorium, and taken through it. At this time, we were not permitted to enter without helmets on our heads. And the floor on which you have been walking these days was just rock. Very, very hard to walk on. It was the largest place I thought I had ever walked into in all my life. All of the exits over here to my left were open, and great trucks were driven in through the doors into this very room. I wondered how in the world it could ever be converted into a place for a meeting. Have you been aware during these days that everything you've been looking at has been constructed just for this meeting? For this room is just a large shell. This platform was built. All of the arch and everything back of us has been constructed, and all will come down during the night on Friday night. This has been erected for our use during the Women's Missionary Union annual meeting, and it will remain throughout the convention. We could not have afforded all of this for our meeting, and the convention couldn't have afforded all of it for the convention, and all of the agencies together couldn't have afforded it for the presentations we are going to have during the convention. But together, by coordinating our plans for programming, we were able to erect this, which has been certainly for our joy during these days. This evening at 6:45 in this room, the convention opens. Tomorrow evening is an evening you must not miss. If you'll turn in your little song book, which you're to keep, which is your convention program, you will see that the Wednesday evening session begins at 7:15. And the Women's Missionary Union report is on that evening and was inadvertently left off. Dr. W.C. Fields at the Executive Committee in Nashville telephoned his apologies. I want to announce so that everyone here will know by this little book, even though you may get a convention bulletin later that will carry it, that our report comes tomorrow evening just following the opening prayer. So you must come on time if you want to be here for the report. Our president, Mrs. Robert Fling, will speak to our report tomorrow evening. And then if you look at the Wednesday evening program, you will see at 8:45, we have a presentation, Ecclesia, Your Church in the 70s, a dramatic presentation presented by the Sunday School Board, Women's Missionary Union, and the Brotherhood Commission. You cannot know our joy when the Order of Business Committee offered 1 hour on the convention program on Wednesday night for church program organizations, those of us who plan for the life, the curriculum, the plans that are carried on in the churches, for us to present to this convention your church in the 70s. You would be interested to know that the men we have brought here because of their know-how, some of them have helped us for years, are here, three of them this year, to help us besides all of those we found here in New Orleans. And when I arrived here at 8 this morning, I was told that those people were still here at 5 a.m. rehearsing for tomorrow night. And so you would not want to miss the Wednesday evening presentation. You don't want to miss anything. If you're here, you might as well go to the convention and know everything that's going on. I try never to miss anything. But let me skip on over until Friday. Friday has always been a hard day at the convention because so many people go home. If you haven't made up your mind yet what you're going to do, let me make it up for you. Just stay. We need you here. We like for the convention to end on a high, strong note. The Home Mission Board and Dr. Criswell together have worked very, very hard in making plans for the Friday afternoon and the Friday evening sessions. And if you will study your program, you will see that the Friday afternoon session is a time of preparation for an evangelistic service that is to be held here in this auditorium on Friday evening. I was thrilled when I looked at the program to see that again we'll have an opportunity to hear Mr. David Fite, Dr. Herbert Caudle. There are others there that you would not want to miss on Friday afternoon. Friday is a very special day for us. For as the program was being planned for that day, a telephone call came to our Women's Missionary Union headquarters in Birmingham, asking if we could do anything to get the people in the churches to give support to this evangelistic effort. It seems so right for us to have a night of evangelism here. For when our convention was organized back in 1845, I believe the record shows that one of the areas of focus for the Board of Domestic Missions was New Orleans. And the need continues to this day for the proclamation of the gospel in this city. I am thrilled that all over our convention territories, there are churches even now with preparations for gathering together to pray. As those of us who are here meet to pray, to prepare, and to actually participate in the service. I telephoned a state paper editor last week to thank him for front page coverage to these prayer meetings in the churches. And he told me that in his state, he had reports of churches that had planned to have all night prayer meetings the night before, certain people coming at 1 hour and others at another hour. And he said the plans are thrilling. Won't you be a part of the Friday services, whether you're here in New Orleans or whether you have gone back home? Let us remember that we have a witness to share in this city that so sorely needs it, as our witness is also needed in the areas where we live.
Perhaps you are conscious that the nominating committee is made up of the 26 state WMU presidents who serve as our vice presidents. At this time, I would like Mrs. Lobaugh, I'm going to have her come make the announcement. Yeah, all right, all right, I won't skip you. At this time, I would like to recognize Ms. Lobaugh to come and make the announcement of the meeting which she called yesterday at noon. And she would announce to us the organization of the 1970 nominating committee.
Mrs. Clyde Skidmore of California will be the chairman. Mrs. D. Isabel of Tennessee will be the co-chairman. Mrs. Edward L. Byrd of South Carolina will be the secretary.
I thought the president was getting ready to call for the nominating committee's report, and I have another speech undelivered. I'm trying to get all my undelivered speeches made before the time for adjournment comes. This morning I told those who were here that our president, Mrs. Robert Fling, had declined the nomination for president again. It did not seem quite to fit in at that time to announce that also our recording secretary, Mrs. J.R. Lobaugh, when asked by the nominating committee to allow her name to be placed in nomination again, declined. Her reason was not the same, but was similar. Both gave reasons to the nominating committee that the committee could not question. They accepted with regret and yet with deep appreciation for what these two have meant to us. Mrs. Lobaugh has been a steady, person on our executive board. Many times I have heard Mrs. Fling say that when there was a problem, she always tried early to get in touch with Mrs. Lobol, for she so wanted her prayer support. We count on her, for she is a woman of prayer, and we know that she is always in prayer for the work that we are doing, whether she is with us or not. She is heavily involved in mission work in her own church, a leader in Women's Missionary Union, a former president of her state WMU, but a wonderful person in the community in which she lives and the church in which she serves. And just now, the program there seems to need her to such an extent that she feels she must devote her full time to it. And so before the nominating committee comes to bring its report, we wanted to make this announcement to you that you might understand that she was invited but felt led to decline the nomination. And also that we, in behalf of Women's Missionary Union, might present to her something by which she can remember her years of service with us. It is not like gold, untarnishable, Elizabeth. It is silver and will tarnish, but it is sterling. And so you can polish it back and bring it up again, all of the beauty that we see in it today. A sterling silver sandwich tray in which we have written, presented by Women's Missionary Union SBC with appreciation to Mrs. J.R. Lobol, Recording Secretary, 1963-1969. And truly this comes to you with our heartfelt appreciation for what you have done for us and the knowledge that you will continue to be on the team with us.
Thank you so much, Alma. I love every one of you very much, and I thank you from the bottom of my heart.
We have now come to our business period, our time of election of officers, and I recognize the vice chairman of the 1969 nominating committee, Mrs. Gilbert Scar, who is vice president, Oregon, Washington. Mrs. Scar.
Thank you. Before presenting the report to the nominating committee, the committee wishes to point out the bylaw provision in Article 4, Section 3, that says, elected officers shall not be engaged, employed by Women's Missionary Union concurrent with her terms of service. The committee has secured permission from the nominee for president with the understanding that her employment by Women's Missionary Union will cease at the time of her election. The committee will present the following nominees. President, Mrs. R.L. Mathis from Alabama. Recording Secretary, Mrs. Roy Snyder, Arkansas. Member at large, Mrs. John McGuire, Florida. Only one nominee for member at large is presented, as we have already the other seven members serving at this time.
Thank you. You have heard the name of Mrs. R.L. Mathis for president. Are there other nominations? If not, those favoring the election of Mrs. Mathis will say aye. Those opposed, no. And the motion is carried. And I will ask Ms. Alma Hunt to escort Mrs. Mathis to the platform. I think our stage manager had to suddenly put on her hat so she could come up here and be presented to you. Ms. Mathis, I feel so right, so happy, so delighted to hand you this gavel. Ms. Mathis, as you know, has served as our Promotion Division Director of Women's Missionary Union. She will be spending time now, more time at Baylor, as the director of the Student Union Building there. As you know, she is the 10th president of Woman's Missionary Union, a vice president of the Baptist World Alliance, treasurer of the Women's Department of the Baptist World Alliance. She traveled on 6 continents in 13 months last year, and she is the program chairman for the Tokyo meeting of the Baptist World Alliance. And so now our 10th president of Woman's Missionary Union becomes the 12th president. She has had many responsibilities and many honors during these years. But Marie, you have not had a greater honor than comes to you in this moment to be called back into service by Woman's Missionary Union in this particular place. I have long called Miss Hunt Chief, sometimes Chiefy. I've called you Prexy, and I've had to break myself for the last 6 years of saying that. But in this moment, I claim the privilege of saying, God bless you, Prexy. Now, they're going to want to hear from you.
Sit down, please. You may be seated. You know, I don't know why Helen gave me this gavel. I've never seen her use it. But since this is the last time that I will ever have an opportunity to walk across the stage, which I hate to do, to take her a glass of water, I'm going to pick up this glass of water and take a sip from it just once. For that is what our president, Helen Fling, has always had in hand, is that precious glass of water. I have mingled emotions and no time to express them. But I will try to be scriptural and express 3, and perhaps say a little poem. 1, I think perhaps my major emotion at this moment, I heard for the first time that upon my election, if elected, and that's why I didn't put my hat on until you elected me, was that I could no longer be an employee of Woman's Missionary Union. And so I have to give up a wonderful staff. And I would like to ask my staff to stand before I sit down, because I've not quite gone out of office yet as promotion division director. And I think most of them are seated over here, and if you'll forgive me, I'll ask them to stand. The other emotion which I feel very deeply this afternoon is that no woman has the right to have this privilege a second time. For there is no greater privilege than to serve as president of Woman's Missionary Union. And I want to thank you for giving me this opportunity again. Perhaps I didn't do very well the first time, and you just mean to give me a second chance. If that's it, I'll try to do better. But really, I'd rather be over on the side and listen to Helen Fling. I wasn't in favor of her going out of office. The third emotion which I feel, I may express in my hope for the future. I left on the table over there, where I left a few other things, 2 books. One is entitled The Dynamic Church. The other is entitled The 70s Opportunities for Your Church. I believe in a dynamic church in the 70s, and I believe that every church may be a dynamic church in the 70s. I hope that you are committed to all the plans and opportunities that will be ours to have a dynamic church in every single Southern Baptist church in our convention. If anyone should ask you or should ask me, do you ever feel insecure or uncertain about the future? I hope that your answer will be the same as mine. No, I feel no insecurity, no uncertainty about the future, for our plans are glorious. God is giving us another opportunity to develop dynamic churches to meet the opportunities of the 70s. And so I hope that you will join with me and all the leaders who are at home, our pastors who are here or who are at home, all of our people and our convention who hope and pray to go forward in the 70s, that together we will not express any feeling of pessimism, but that we will be optimistic and enthusiastic and pray that we shall go forward in every sense of the word in the 70s. Thank you so very much for this wonderful opportunity.
It's impossible for a man to get in front of the women in a group like this. It's almost difficult to get in even on the front row. But I would like to speak for a group of men who are beyond the Women's Missionary Union group, who join in congratulating Mrs. Mathis on her election as president. I'm representing the Church Program Development Group, a group of individuals representing the programs of the Sunday School Board, the Women's Missionary Union, and the Brotherhood Commission, who meet every month. And Mrs. Mathis, for many, many months, has been the sole lady on the group. And I assure you, she has done more than a little for our group. She has lent us charm and grace that we needed drastically, as well as beauty, and she has encouraged us and discouraged us as it was appropriate. She has made much contribution to us. She has joined with us in our sorrows and in our rejoicing. She has helped us in so many, many ways, not the least of which is to slap our wrists every once in a while. We want to express to her our congratulations and our deep, deep feelings for her new responsibility here, and to present her these roses as a token of our best wishes and our love from her boyfriends on this Church Program Development Group.
This is Pat Clendenning, one of our members. I suppose I have been sitting with about 12 to 14 men. I've whipped them so many times I can't imagine they'd give me a bouquet of roses. Thank you so much.
I recognize our recording secretary to read the list of the vice presidents, and I will ask each of these vice presidents to stand as her name is read.
I should like to read Article 5, Section 2. The vice presidents shall be recognized as officers of Women's Missionary Union by virtue of their election as presidents of state Women's Missionary Unions. The Vice Presidents, Alabama, Mrs. J.W. Triplett, Arizona, Mrs. R.Q. Kinney, Arkansas, Mrs. J.A. Hogan, California, Mrs. Clyde Skidmore, Colorado, Mrs. George E. Ray, Sr., Washington, D.C., Mrs. Eugene Botts, Florida, Mrs. August A. Leonard, Jr., Georgia, Mrs. J.J. Clyatt, Illinois, Mrs. J.M. Laughlin, Indiana, Mrs. R.P. Griffin, Kansas, Mrs. Max Briggs, Kentucky, Mrs. J.S. Woodward, Louisiana, Mrs. Carl Conrad, Maryland, Mrs. William L. Andrews, Michigan, Mrs. J. Brown, Mississippi, Mrs. Vernon May, Missouri, Mrs. Hughes Sheriff, New Mexico, Mrs. O.D. Lambert, North Carolina, Mrs. R. Nolan Benfield, Ohio, Mrs. C.E. Price, Oklahoma, Mrs. Robert Bazell, Oregon, Washington, Mrs. Gilbert Scar, South Carolina, Mrs. Edward L. Byrd, Tennessee, Mrs. D. Isabel, Texas, Mrs. H. C. Hunt, Virginia, Mrs. E. S. Stratton.
You have heard the name of Mrs. Roy Snyder as proposed as the secretary. Are there other nominations? If not, those favoring the election of Mrs. Snyder will please say aye. Those opposed, no. And Mrs. Snyder is elected. Ms. Snyder was on the platform with us this morning. She's seated over here. I'm going to ask her to stand and turn around so that our audience may see you again. And Ms. Snyder, when our service is over, I'd like you to come up and join these on the platform. Now, for member at large, you have heard the name of Mrs. John McGuire of Florida. Are there other nominations for this place? If not, those favoring the election of Mrs. McGuire will say aye. Those opposed, no. And Mrs. McGuire is elected. Ms. McGuire, will you stand? Way over here to the far right. And we will ask you also to come up and greet your friends at the end of our service today. Now, in just a little while, Dr. Ray will come to bring us a solo. And then we will turn our minds toward something to which we have looked for a long time, this dialogue between Kenneth Chapin and Dr. Elton Trueblood on the future of the Christian faith. I'm going to ask right now for just this moment, quickly, that the men in this audience will stand. May we see you stand. How we do appreciate. Thank you so much. How much we do appreciate the pastors and the men, the backing of our pastors and laymen. And I know that you also look forward and will be praying for this afternoon because you've looked forward to hearing this discussion. A few minutes ago, I saw some of you smile when Dr. Kenneth Chapin put his arm around me and patted me on the platform. This is his way, always. No, I really did.
I think I would rather demonstrate what I did than have her explain it to you.
He is our friend and always offers his word of encouragement. Through these years, we have called him the Father Confessor of the WMU, for we have turned to him for advice from time to time. This wonderful professor of evangelism at Southern Seminary. Yesterday afternoon, I presented Dr. Elton Trueblood and spoke to you about him. But this afternoon, I'm simply going to turn this presentation to Dr. Chapin and ask him to tell you the delightful story of his connections and of the influence of the life of Dr. Elton Trueblood in his own life. Dr. Kenneth Chapin.
My name is not Kenneth Chapin. Sometimes we've been called brothers. I would be glad to claim him. I'd like to thank our musicians at this time for their wonderful support during these days. Mr. Tommy Brinkley from First Baptist Church, Wichita Falls, Texas. Betty Jane Chatham, Mrs. Don Chatham from Shelbyville, Kentucky, who incidentally has an album in the bookstore you might like to take home with you, This Love Is Mine. Mr. Phil Driscoll from Baylor University, who has thrilled our hearts with his trumpet playing. He has A Touch of Trumpet, I believe is the title of his album, A Touch of Trumpet in the bookstore. I'd like to thank them, the Samford University Choir, for the wonderful support they've given this program this year. I told Helen this was really her last fling, and it's been a tremendous experience to be a part of this WMU convention. The Cross by Harriet Ware.
Until you set the cross up in your heart. Until you set the cross up in your heart. I know I cannot live until I die. I know I cannot live until I die. Till I am nailed upon it.
upon it wild and high and sleep in the tomb for a full 3 days dead with angels at the feet and head. But then in a great brightness shall I arise. But then in a great brightness shall I the skies, to walk with stiller feet below the sky. A friend, you never choose the better part until you set Christ's cross up in your heart. Until you set the cross up in your
It's a very great joy to be a part of this wonderful program that we've experienced here in these days. And I know you share with me, as a Southern Baptist, a great joy in having with us for this program Dr. Elton Trueblood. I sat recently with a group of young leaders from all of the denominations in America who are involved in evangelism and renewal. And we went around the table and we were amazed to discover that practically every one of us had a certain spiritual debt to Elton Trueblood. Keith Miller, who probably is exerting at this moment one of the great influences on the life of the church through his writing. Robert Raines, and a number of other people, Dr. Trueblood, gave testimony to the imprint that you have made on their life. I first met Dr. Trueblood on a very miserable occasion. I wrote my doctor's thesis on Dr. Trueblood, and they gave me my doctor's degree, and I put my thesis in the library and thought that was it. And I walked into the faculty lounge at Southwestern Seminary, and someone had brought him over from TCU, where he was lecturing, and introduced him to me, and he said, "Aren't you the one who wrote on me?" I said, "Yes, sir, I did. I got a doctor's degree writing on you." He said, "You didn't send me a copy of the thesis." I said, "Well, I didn't realize you would be interested in the thesis." He said, "I'd like to read it." I said, I'll mail it to you." He said, "No, I have a little time this afternoon over at TCU. Why don't you bring it over?" Well, I thought I'd be like the third little pig, you know. I was going to take it at 2 and go back at 4 when I knew he'd be gone. And I got over there at 2 o'clock. He was sitting on the steps. He said, "You know, I had 2 conferences canceled this afternoon. Sit down here and let me read this thesis." And I made a decision, if I ever write another thesis, the person about whom I write it will be very, very dead. Well, that person is very, very alive. He and I are going to stand here for about 30 minutes and talk about things going on in the church. And then I've been asked to take just a moment to give a word of challenge to you and read a scripture before we close this session. Dr. Trueblood, it's a joy to stand here with you, and I'm going to claim the privilege of asking the first question. Would you come? I've been reading a great deal lately about a young man who's president of the Christian Herald who has written a book called The Last Days of the Church. And he's suggesting that we declare a moratorium on church building for perhaps 1,000 years. And I noticed yesterday in your message to us that you ended your message by saying that we are in the beginning days of the church. Now, I would like for you to respond to this title, The Last Days of the Church.
Well, now, before I can do that, I think I need a drink. Now, I don't know what Helen Fling has in this, but whatever it is, I'd like to have some of it. Now I feel strong enough, Kenneth, to answer your question. My conviction is based on this, Kenneth. The church has lasted a long time. It has had a most amazing endurance. It endured in the face of the Roman opposition. It endured in the face of the Hellenic condescension. It lived through the Dark Ages. It lived through the Middle Ages, through the Renaissance, and through the Reformation, and it has lived through the Industrial Revolution. I think it will go on. I believe that one of the greatest sentences of the Bible is the word of Christ when he says, "The gates of hell will not prevail against it." And therefore, I have every reason to believe that we are in the early days of the Christian faith.
I wonder if you'd point out some things that you see happening, because I sensed as I sat down there on the front row and listened to you that you actually were seeing things taking place in the church that were more like birth pangs than they were the death rattle. And in a day when we are reading so much cynicism, I'd like from your vantage point in the history of the church, what is it that you're seeing taking place that would make you say these are the early days?
I see many things. Let me mention kind of three quite briefly. First, this amazing growth of the idea of the universal ministry to which you and I are so strongly committed.
And the laity is here today.
That is, I suppose that of these, say, 7,000 people or so that we see in front of us, only a minority are clergymen. And yet there is a deep sense in which everyone is a minister. Now this we all accept today. You can remember a time when we did not. This is a tremendous advance. A second one is the great growth in the acceptance of the small group idea. Hundreds and hundreds of these small groups devoted to witness and to fellowship and to prayer and to study. And they have remade many churches. The third thing that I see is the growth of what I would call occupational or vocational evangelism. We are developing ways of reaching doctors with doctors, lawyers with lawyers. We are finding ways to make the occupational units the natural units of the Christian cause.
Now, I know that you devoted a great deal of your time to the college and to lecturing on the college scene, and last night I raised a question, and I want to see if you've been thinking about it. There's a great host of our country that are not college-oriented. They are a people of the land. They are well-employed now. They are making money. They are buying things, but they are not in the church. Do you see any sign that the church, do you see any ways in which the church may reach out to them? Do you have a word to us on this?
That's a great question. I think the chief way for most people will be through the printed word. If I could see, say, 7,000 of you engaged in the ministry of the printed word, if you would have little books that you could take and hand to people who are in difficulties and puzzlement and confusion, one to one to one. This is how they can be reached. Many of them will not come to a public meeting like this, but they may listen to what is said by people who are their neighbors and co-workers. This is why we cannot leave it to the professionals. It has to be done by the rank and file.
I'm going to keep on asking questions.
Go ahead.
Because I think I've got more questions and you have more answers, so I want to ask you another one. Yesterday in your talk, you made a stool that had only three legs. I have not had good luck with three-legged stools.
But they'll hold up, you know.
I suppose so. I want to ask you about a couple of the legs on that stool. One of them had to do with the inner life, with a commitment to Jesus Christ. And this has always been an influence that you've had. And I remember when you came to Southwestern, you talked to young men about reading the Bible and praying and this sort of thing.
And that shocked the Baptists, didn't it?
Yeah, we didn't know that the Quakers believed in that. The other was the intellectual life, and the other was the social implications. Now, we are beginning to hear a great deal about polarization of two of these legs, not the intellectual and the spiritual, but social and the evangelical. And you are a man who, in his whole tradition, have put these together. How important is it that they stay together?
This is probably the greatest question that I can imagine for this afternoon as we talk about the future. Now, if in the future we allow polarization to go on, this will be a great disaster. That is, this polarization is not a division between denominations. It goes right down the middle of every congregation that we know. On the one hand, the persons concerned with the inner life of prayer and devotion and commitment. And on the other hand, that of the people who remember that Christ said, "Inasmuch as ye did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, ye did it to me." And this gives the whole basis of what is called social activism in the church. Now the shame is, the utter shame is, that in congregation after congregation, these are becoming parties. The division in the modern Christian world is not between denominations. That's obsolete. It is between parties within denominations. The persons concerned with the inner life look upon those in the activist role as being merely superficial. And the people in the activist role look upon those concerned with the inner life as being not with it. And so they look at each other with mutual contempt. You're well aware of that, Kent.
Yes, I am. I see this thing happening, I think, with the young ministers in our own denomination, the struggle to find a mission action that matches with Christian compassion the needs of modern man and struggles to see man not only as a citizen of the kingdom of God, but in the wholeness of his citizenship here, is, I think, one of the gifts that God has given to his church in this day. But I've noticed that many people have felt that it has been given as an alternative to the proclaiming of the word of forgiveness and of hope and of reconciliation for the individual, so that I am feeling the tension myself as a young minister in the church, and I'm sure that many of the lay people feel the tension. I think some of these women who are becoming involved in mission action are wondering, as they involve themselves, now, how do these go together?
Now, this is the heart of our question. If either of these is kept alone, it becomes evil. Let's get that absolutely straight. They are perfectly wonderful when they are combined. They are evil when they are separated. And let me show you why. If you have only the inner life of devotion and prayer, then that can become self-centered. You can be utterly untouched then by injustice and by poverty because those don't seem to be the center of your concern. On the other hand, if you are nothing but an activist, without the humility and depth that come from the life of prayer and devotion, here's what happens. You become bitter, denunciatory, harsh, unloving, and horribly self-righteous. Some of the protesters are among the most self-righteous people you will ever see in all the world. Just see anger sticking right out of their faces. Now you see, the evil thing is to say either or. The glorious Christian word is the word and. I've been so moved lately by a sentence from Christ. If you look at it carefully, you will find it in Matthew chapter 13, verse 52, about the new and the old, where we have another polarization, you know, the contemporary and the traditionalist. You've heard about that, haven't you? And Christ said, everyone who is instructed in the kingdom is like a householder who brings out of his treasure what is new and what is old. That's glorious, isn't it?
Tremendous.
In many ways, the greatest word of the New Testament is this conjunction, this word and.
I think this is the part of the struggle, though, that we are discovering. What is it that is to be permanent in the life of the church? What is it that is to be transient in the life of the church? What is it that's new that we should bring into the church? What is it that's old that we should hang on to?
You tell me. You've been asking me questions. I want to see if you can answer it.
I was hoping we could go to 4 o'clock with the questions from me and the answers from you. Dr. Trueblood, I suppose that I've gone the route that any young man goes who loves the church and yet who becomes aware of the tremendous needs that
we
have in the world.
Are you speaking of yourself as a young man now or not?
Yes, I am.
All right, good. The way the church is young.
I'm glad you're not sensitive about your age,
all
Dr.
Right,
Trueblood. I was going to ask him what professor at large meant, but...
Well, let me tell you.
We ate dinner together last night, and I know what it means.
You see, 3 years ago, I had a wonderful liberation. I say to any of you, get 65 as fast as you can. It's perfectly wonderful. Now I am liberated, and I can be a missionary to the Baptists if I want to. I did not want to be Professor Emeritus. You understand why, don't you? That's a bad word. That's a Latin word. E means he's out. Emeritus means he deserves to be. All right, now you tell me what is going to remain and what's going to change.
You know, I was recently involved in a discussion where I discovered that I wanted to see the church change, but everybody else in the discussion didn't want to see it go on. And this is an interesting place for those of us who are always wanting to change things to be in, to find ourselves no longer where we can be the reactor, but where we have to be the affirmer. And I found myself for the first time saying what I have felt for a great length of time, that I am convinced that the church is God's idea, that it is not some thing that belongs to man at a certain socioeconomic level, that it is a part of the plan of God for his people.
That's great. It would have died a long time ago if that hadn't been true.
Yes, I think this is true, and I think that as we are struggling, say, with the city, people feel that the church doesn't have anything that it can do with a city unless it can change completely all of the secular structures of the city. Well, in the first place, I am a little bit pessimistic about what all can be done along that line. Although I'm going to keep on trying, I'm going to keep on registering, keep on voting, keep on supporting people who represent what I think to be the best understanding of the role of government. But it seems to me that the church that does not feel that it has a word for this day, a word to persons, a word to persons in all circumstances and in all relationships, is a church that is bound to become very, very cynical, because
to feel that God put you in such an exciting day and your word was for some other period of time, I think would be a tragedy. So that I'm convinced not only that the church is a part of God's plan, but that it has a word of hope and a word of forgiveness and a word of reconciliation, and that it has the possibility, if it is willing to be sensitive to the Spirit of God, to be a community likened to no other community. And I'm thinking in urban America how desperately people need a group of people where they can know and be known and still be loved, where they can find acceptance that's not connected with approval, where they can not pretend and yet be loved. And so I'm seeing more and more of hope for a word that is to recover relevance and for the church as a meaningful body in American society.
I like that very much, and there are so many people, including many in this great hall today, who believe that and know it, that I think this is going to happen. I think that in many ways the church right now is being reborn, that out of the fires of our present persecution, we are having some persecution, we are looked upon by many people with absolute contempt, but out of this, I believe there is coming one of the greatest days in the life of the church.
I have been using a phrase that it seems to me that the church, while it is God's idea, not man's, it has picked up a lot out of his culture that really hinders it in doing the work of God. And it's sort of like a snowball that rolls down a hill and it picks up some sticks and some leaves and some trash that pollute the purity of it. Now, it would seem to me that the very exciting and challenging day in which we live, and the fact that the accusing finger has been pointed at the church and it's been suggested that we have no word and that we have no reason for being, is going to cause us to drop away those things that are superficial and to discover what is the essence of the word, why we are here, what our mission is. So that I actually would agree with you that I see the day as a day for rebirth and a day for renewal and a day for a recommitment to the mission of the church.
Well, I like that very much, and I'm convinced that perhaps David Poling is right, that we ought to play down buildings. They are beginning to be too ostentatious, too much in evidence of wealth. The life of the church is never in the building. The life of the church is always in the hearts of the people. And I would have you remember that the church in its first great period of vitality in the first 250 years owned no buildings at all.
I think as we move to change, though, that before we get into the thick of battle, there's going to have to be a great deal of very realistic thinking about what you keep and what you throw away.
That's right. We want to throw away anything that hinders. We want to keep anything that will help to make the church a redemptive society for the whole world.
Before you sit down, I want to try a list out on you.
All right.
I was asked to make a list of what I would consider to be absolutely minimal. In this changing world with all the things that are going to change, what would I still have to have and still call it church?
Good.
And this was a different question than I'd ever been asked. I have always felt the church was sort of an overloaded lifeboat that was still picking up stuff, you know, and it just keeps sinking lower and lower in the water. But when somebody suggests that we're going to have to lighten the lifeboat, and they raise the question, not what are you going to get rid of, but what do you have to keep, still call it the lifeboat? Now, here's my list, and let me try it on you, my dear friend. Worship.
Right.
I won't fight for the building, or the day, or the hour, or the form, or whether you choreograph the choir, but worship, we've got to have it.
All right.
Adult Bible study. In other words, the Bible I see is a very key book.
In other words, that will be the training of the universal ministry.
That's right. A third thing, Christian fellowship, a community where people know each other and actually love each other, that this has to be.
Good.
A fourth thing, witness, evangelism, missions. A fifth thing, ministry. And I think that you can change it around all you want to. You can change the architecture or do away with the architecture. If you let me hang on to these five, I'm still willing to join with you and call it church. But this is the minimum. You want to add to my list or take off?
Oh, no, I want it right that way, and I want you to write a book about that and have that be five chapters.
Thank you, Dr. Bud. I have a word of challenge to us and a scripture from the Word of God. I started to write down a charge to the women, but the truth is it's a prayer for myself, and I suppose a prayer for you. In the past several years, I have come to have an amazing sense of confidence concerning the potential of those of you who are part of the lives of the churches. And so I've got three prayers. I'm like Ms. Mathis. I have three parts to my prayer, and then a passage of Scripture from the book of Revelation. First, I pray that in this very wonderful day in which God is allowing me to live, that I will be able to see God at work. Now, I am convinced that there is not a person living on the face of the earth that God does not love. And I am convinced that there is not a person living on the face of the earth that God is not struggling with in all of the circumstances of his life. And yet I am equally convinced that sometimes it is difficult for me to see God at work. And it is difficult for you to see God at work. Do you recall when the Holy Spirit came to Simon Peter, when he was at the house in Joppa of Simon the Tanner, and he said, I want you to see what I am doing in Caesarea. And Simon Peter checked his file and said, you aren't doing anything in Caesarea. We do not have any work there. You recall? No. You see, here was the servant of God who could not really believe that the outreach of God and the work of God and the stirring of God could move beyond his own comprehension. Now, I'm praying that you and I, as we go home and as we look around, will be given eyes with which to see the Spirit of God at work in the lives of people and in the events of history. I have a second prayer, that God will give me courage enough to localize my interest in missions. Now, I was taught about missions by Woman's Missionary Union. As a college freshman pastoring my first church, the WMU president came up to me and said, it's the third week in December, and I haven't heard a word about Lottie Moon. And I said, Lottie who? And she put my name on every list in Birmingham and Atlanta and Richmond and Nashville and Albuquerque. And I learned. And I hope that Woman's Missionary Union never gives up on missionary education. I was taught to pray and to give by the tremendous thrust in missionary giving that was initiated in our denomination and carried forth by Baptist women. And I would not want you to give that up. And as I sat here and listened to Mrs. Dorr plead with you, not only to come, but pray, I thought, I hope the day never comes, Dr. Coffin, when we will not pray for God to call out many of the finest among us to go as missionaries, as a part of what it means to be a missionary. But it seems to me, as I've sat here during these days, that God is calling me to consider where I am in a local congregation on mission. And that perhaps we ought to get Dr. Rutledge to come and sit here next to Dr. Coffin, and at the close of these moments to come and commission every one of us where we are to be a part of the mission of God. Now, you see, it is one thing to study about Adoniram Judson. It's another thing to pray about missions in the Middle East. It's another thing to start giving sacrificially, but suddenly to become God's missionaries in Jackson, Mississippi, and in Louisville, Kentucky, and in Detroit, Michigan. And I think this is what God is calling us to do. And it's a thing that will take love, it will take courage, it will take patience, it will take commitment, it will take confrontation, it will take our willingness to live without unanimity all of the time. But I am praying that God will give us the courage. And finally, I would pray that as we move out into the world to do his work, that we would move with an inner confidence in the ultimate triumph of the kingdom of God and of the people of God. There's a certain pessimism in the church these days that sounds almost like a death wish as we talk back and forth about how bad things are. And yet I think that it's entirely within the realm of Christian realism, Dr. Trueblood, to say that the children of God ought to live with great confidence in the ultimate triumph of the people of God. You know, when I quit really having to be mad about an issue, when I finally figure out which side God is on in that issue, and I can work relaxed. The only way I ever got to the place and just talking with my friends about race relations was when it finally occurred to me that the whole nature of God and the whole movement of God in history was on the side of justice. And that just as surely as God raised Jesus up from the dead, ultimately justice would triumph over injustice. And love would triumph over hate. And life would triumph over death. But let me tell you something. We do not always act like winners. We have begun to talk like losers. We have begun to think like losers. We have begun to whine like losers. And it's because I think we do not understand the hope that we have as children of God. When I went to the University of New Mexico, I took a course in Shakespeare. And the professor that taught me felt that Shakespeare basically had written only Hamlet because we devoted 18 of the 32 weeks to Hamlet. We memorized the soliloquies, we memorized dialogues, we psychoanalyzed poor Hamlet. And when I thought we were completely through with him, Laurence Olivier, the movie Hamlet with Laurence Olivier, and it came to the campus theater. And since the movie was open on the afternoon, and our class met in the afternoon, the professor said, just drop everything, we're going over to the theater to see Hamlet. I was getting ready to go in, and a boy from the Student Union building was standing there, and he wasn't in our class. And he said, hey, Chafin, are you going to the show? I said, yes. He said, I think I'll go too. He bought a ticket, got some popcorn. He went in there, began to munch his popcorn, and watch Hamlet. And as far as he was concerned, it could have been a Perry Mason or a Gunsmoke or anything else, you know. Well, he got interested in this story. And he became curious about what was going to happen. And he said, what do you think's going to happen? And I told him. And it did. And so all the way through the movie, he would say, what's going to happen? And I would tell him. And it did. And when we got outside, he said, Chafin, have you already seen this? And I said, no, I haven't. And he shook his head and walked away. And I thought, the poor guy, he was probably the only person in the entire theater who didn't know from the beginning how it was going to end. Now listen to me. The scripture says, I am Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. And the people of God who go into the world to love those who are unloved, to feed those who are hungry, to clothe those who are without clothes, to visit those who are in prison, and to preach the gospel to the poor ought to go with this hope in their heart. I want to close by reading a passage from the 21st chapter of Revelation, which is a word that God has been speaking to me a great deal lately. It's a word of challenge and a word of hope. It's good news for our day. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had vanished, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, made ready like a bride adorned for her husband. I heard a loud voice proclaiming from the throne, now at last God has his dwelling among men. He will dwell among them, and they shall be his people, and God himself will be with them. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There shall be an end to death and to mourning and crying and pain, for the old order has passed away. Then he who sat on the throne said, Behold, I am making all things new. And he said to me, Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true. Indeed, he said, they are already fulfilled. For I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. A drop from the water springs of life will be my free gift to the thirsty. All this is the victor's heritage, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. Amen.